Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrick Gibson, a principal at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. We are excited to introduce you all to a new segment we have beginning on this podcast and we'll have going forward. We're calling it Housing Happenings, which will be led by our own Baker Tilly colleague, Larissa Fogarty. Larissa, thanks for joining us today and going forward, right?
Thanks, Don. As Don mentioned, I'm Larissa Fogarty, a senior manager on the affordable housing team. I spend most of my time working on financial models, LIHTC, and soft funding applications, and partnering with housing authorities on repositioning their existing public housing portfolios, along with a range of other housing initiatives and really whatever is sent my way. I'm really excited to be joining the Buzz House crew and bringing Housing Happenings segment to our listeners. With that, we have a few big industry updates to share on this week's episode. The first topic we're going to talk about today is the Road to Housing Act. As many of you may know, the Road to Housing Act passed in a House vote on May 20th. There's a lot of things we could talk about within this bill, but today I really just want to hit on a few key provisions in the Road to Housing Act. They're getting a lot of attention in the affordable housing space. First, on the preservation side, Section 201 of the Act focuses on the Rental Assistance Demonstration, or RAD program. The big headline here is that it removes both the cap on the number of units that can convert and the program sunset date. Right now, RAD is limited to 455,000 units and is only authorized through 2029. This basically takes off these constraints and makes it a permanent tool. It gives housing authorities more certainty that they can continue converting public housing to a more stable, long-term Section 8 platform while still maintaining tenant protections. Next, if we look at Section 204, this is more on the capital side. It raises the cap on bank public welfare investments from 15% to 20%. And what that means is that banks have more room to invest in things like LIHTC, new market tax credits, and opportunity zones. And in practical terms, that's adding additional potential equity flowing into affordable housing and community development. And at a time when deals are getting really hard to pencil and there's more supply than demand, expanding that capital base is really going to be essential to getting deals done. Lastly, on the production side, Section 501 reauthorizes and modernizes the HOME program. It not only reauthorizes HOME, but it also builds in annual funding increases through 2029, which provides some much-needed predictability. But just as important as the funding are the policy changes. The bill gives more flexibility to local jurisdictions, expands eligibility to more nonprofits and community land trusts, and, this is key, it streamlines a lot of the compliance requirements that have historically slowed deals down. This includes environmental reviews and inspections, which can add real time and cost. It also calls for a review of Build America, Buy America, which reflects the growing concern in the industry that these requirements, while well-intended, may be adding cost and complexity to affordable housing developments. This bipartisan bill now goes back to the Senate, which will go back into session in June. So we'll keep all of our listeners updated with what's happening in the next few episodes. Another recent policy shift that's also worth calling out is HUD's decision to wind down the Restore and Rebuild program. They're no longer accepting new requests for what's called a Notice of Anticipated RAD Rent, or NARR. And at a high level, this matters a lot for public housing authorities because Restore or Rebuild, previously known as Faircloth to RAD, was one of the very few tools that actually helped grow the supply of deeply affordable housing developed by public housing authorities. Public housing authorities could use their unused Faircloth authority to rebuild units that they had lost over time without needing congressional approval. And the real advantage was that it created a one-step process. You could do your mixed finance development and your RAD conversion at the same time. That meant you could lock in your long-term Section 8 rental assistance up front, which made deals way more feasible. And importantly, it kept all the units deeply affordable, with residents paying no more than 30% of their income towards rent. And now that the program is going away, that streamlined process disappears. So what does that actually mean? PHAs can still try to develop using Faircloth authority, but it is a much more complicated two-step path now, where you have to convert your units to traditional public housing first through a mixed financing transaction and then come back later through the RAD process completely separate. That alone can easily add a year or more to the timeline that currently exists under the Restore Rebuild program. This decision to wind down the Restore Rebuild program is tied to the administration's budget proposal for fiscal year 2027, which contemplates resetting the faircloth limits to match the number of public housing units that the PHA has as of October 1st, 2027. So, for example, if a public housing authority has 1,000 public housing units as of October 1, 2027, but has 2,000 faircloth units on paper, that faircloth capacity would get cut back down to 1,000. This is a really big deal for PHAs that have already converted most of their units to RAD and don't have many public housing units left, meaning they could lose a significant amount of development capacity if they don't act quickly. The hard part is that even before this change, faircloth units were really hard to use on their own. Public housing rents are just so low to make new construction deals work unless you compare them with something like RAD. And Restore Rebuild solves that by bundling everything together in one step. And now that that option is off the table, it's loss of a pretty efficient tool for getting deeply affordable deals done.
Very good. Thank you very much, Larissa. I'm excited to have you as a permanent member of the Buzzhouse here with Housing Happenings. A lot more with the Road to Housing Act. Larissa will follow up with you, obviously, in our next episode as well. So now we're going to jump into our topic for the day, construction. When working on your multifamily housing project, construction costs are, of course, the largest part of your development budget, often 70 to 80% or so of your development budget. So let's focus on that a little bit. There's so many factors that go into this construction number, and we invited our friend in the industry, Mark Carlson, Vice President of Carlson Construction, to discuss various topics around the construction industry and construction for multifamily properties in today's environment. Now, Garrick and I are very excited to jump into our discussion with Mark, and turn it over to Garrick. Garrick?
All right. Thanks, Don, and thanks for that intro, Larissa. Mark, glad to have you here on the Buzzhouse podcast. Obviously, we want to ask a lot of questions around the construction industry, but before we jump in with these specific questions around construction and housing, why don't you give our listeners some insight into Carlson Construction and your role within the company?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I really appreciate the opportunity to join you guys. I'm a big fan of the Buzzhouse, and it's great to be a part of it. Try not to miss too many episodes. It's pretty exciting and pretty informative. So we're a family-owned construction company based in Chicago, where my brother and I started 37 years ago. Some days I wake up and it's just hard to believe it's been that long. We've had an amazing opportunities to work across a broad range of project types and geographic areas across the U.S. and have five primary business lines we focus on: mission-critical public safety facilities, education, heavy industrial, infrastructure, and of course, housing. A lot of our work today centers around helping owners and development teams navigate projects from early planning all the way through completion. My role in the company is to really develop client relationships and market opportunities that align with our vision and values. I'm involved in business development, pre-construction strategy, client relationships, and helping coordinate the transition from planning into field execution. A big part of my role is making sure the expectations that we establish early in a project, whether it's budget, schedule, operational goals, remain aligned, and then supporting my fellow team members as the project moves to the execution stage. We've always believed that successful projects are built long before construction starts. A lot of emphasis for us is placed on communication, planning, constructability, and early coordination between the owner, design team, and contractor. We bring practical construction insight into the process early enough to help teams make informed decisions before challenges become expensive later on, typically resulting in project delays. In multifamily and affordable housing environments, there are often a lot of moving parts and stakeholders involved. So predictability and collaboration become extremely important. These projects have a lot of moving parts: financing, design, site conditions, unit mix, building systems, long-term maintenance, and most importantly, the resident lived experience. Our role is to help bring practical construction insight into the process so that the project is not only feasible on paper, but buildable, durable, and successful over the long term. We found that the strongest outcomes usually come from teams that communicate openly, stay aligned around the project goals, and approach the process as partners rather than operating in separate silos. That's probably where Carlson fits in and brings the most value to a client. We are part of a team that wants honest feedback, clear communication, and a disciplined approach to getting that concept to completion that's where we work best. We really try to be steady and reliable construction partner, someone who helps projects move from concept to completion in a disciplined and thoughtful way while keeping long-term performance and owner's goals in mind.
Perfect. That's great. So with all that experience and how you guys operate, we want to pick your brain a little bit now and discuss the general trend of overall construction costs that you're seeing. Because obviously we know construction costs from 2020 to 2025, they were up north of like 35%. So could you give us a feel for your observations of overall pricing in the current year in 2026? And also knowing that you actually work across the country, how much does geography actually impact that pricing?
Well, it's definitely been a season. And there is really no question that the industry has gone through a very unusual stretch between 2020 and 2025. Supply chain disruptions, material escalation, labor shortages, interest rate pressure, tariffs, and broader economic uncertainty have created a level of volatility that most owners, developers, and contractors have never experienced before. To say the least, it's been humbling for everyone in the industry. Over the past year, we've started to see some stabilization in portions of the material markets compared to what we've experienced during the peak volatility of the last several years. However, it does not necessarily mean that environment has fully normalized. One thing we are consistently working across different regions of the country is that geography often impacts labor markets and subcontractor depth. More than material pricing itself, it has become somewhat more nationalized, but labor availability, local trade capacity, permitting, environments, and regional competition can vary significantly from one market to another. As an example, Northern Virginia is one of our stronger performing markets, and everywhere you look, there's a crane in the air. A trade contractor and availability of skilled trades has significantly impacted pricing. However, in other markets, especially in rural areas, we are seeing the opposite with deep competition and aggressive pricing. Construction remains very connected to the broader energy and manufacturing conditions in ways that aren't always visible. Fuel, transportation, petrochemical-based products, roofing, insulation, logistics, and manufacturing costs all continue to influence the pricing throughout the supply chain. Especially trade contractors have long memories of the last 5 years or so and are cautious with commitments in this environment. But we have found that the projects performing the best in today's environment are the ones where owners, design teams, and contractors begin collaborating early and have honest conversation around budgeting, scheduling, procurement, and project priorities before drawings are fully complete and procurement becomes urgent. The earlier teams align with realistic expectations and planning, the more predictable the projects become.
Perfect. Mark, on a very related note, and you hit on some of these already, you talked about labor market and even logistics, and you talked about local trades. Could you pinpoint what is the largest driver of cost today, or what's increasing, or what's volatile perhaps in today's economic environment?
Great question. Labor availability. We are operating in an environment with an aging workforce, a shortage of skilled trades and subcontractor capacity that is stretched thin in many markets. In a lot of ways, it's the exact opposite challenge from what the industry experienced 15 years ago, where a significant percentage of the skilled workforce left the industry on account of the availability of work, and trade contractors were exceptionally aggressive with pricing and a willingness to accommodate an aggressive schedule. Today, labor availability and subcontractor depth are often having just as much impact on pricing and schedule as raw material costs themselves. At the same time, buildings have become significantly more sophisticated and complex. Modern multifamily projects involve much more and higher levels of coordination related to code compliance, energy requirements, life safety systems, technology integration, and long-term operational performance. There is a constant balancing act between those growing technical requirements and the realities of budget and schedule. This is especially true with HVAC systems, electrical infrastructure, energy compliance, and overall coordination of building systems. Another major driver of cost escalation is late-stage design changes, which are often made under schedule pressure and create scope revisions. Coordination gaps between plans and specifications, procurement disruptions, and communication challenges among the project team. Even with the strongest management systems and experienced teams, those changes tend to introduce inefficiencies and ultimately impact both cost and schedule. multifamily projects today are highly coordinated systems. When communication, planning, and decision-making breaks down early in the process, costs tend to escalate much more quickly later during construction. That's why collaboration and discipline pre-construction become so important in creating predictable outcomes, particularly in affordable housing environments where budgets and timelines are often very structured from the beginning.
Perfect.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for that. And actually, you kind of touched on a little bit, and maybe you can elaborate a little more, as you mentioned, the earlier you do something, it prevents you from running into issues later. So from your perspective, what are the most critical decisions that are made early that impact the success of a project?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest misconceptions in construction is that projects become winners or losers during construction itself. In reality, most projects are largely defined by the decisions that are made long before anyone mobilizes. The strongest projects we see are usually begin with a very clear understanding of the owner's priorities and a team that's aligned around budget, schedule, quality expectations, and long-term operational goals. One of the most important decisions is bringing the right people into the conversation early enough to influence the outcome. When contractors, architects, engineers, and ownership groups collaborate during pre-construction instead of operating independently, the team is able to identify risks, evaluate alternatives, and make informed decisions before issues become expensive or disruptive later in the process. The early coordination creates a much more predictable environment for everyone involved. Another critical component is making sure the budget, design, and schedule evolve together. Projects that we see that struggle a little bit more have those three elements moving independently with one another. We see situations where the design advances further than the budget support, or schedules are established before procurement realities, permitting timelines, and site conditions are fully understood. The earlier those conversations happen honestly and transparently, the better position the project is for success. I also think communication and team alignment are incredibly important. The projects that tend to perform the best are usually the ones where the owner, design team, and contractor are all solving problems together rather than protecting their own silos. Good communication early creates trust, and that trust becomes very important once construction is underway and decisions are needed to be made quickly. In affordable housing and multifamily environments where projects are often operating with very defined budget, financing structures, and timelines, discipline pre-construction becomes even more important. There are usually far less flexibility once projects move into execution. So thoughtful planning and early coordination have significant impact on the overall success of the development. Pre-construction is really where problems are solved inexpensively. The more disciplined and collaborative the planning process is up front, the more predictable the project outcomes once construction begins.
Perfect. Mark, and you really probably hit a lot of this with that response, but just that early collaboration, I think talked on about three or four of your answers so far, and really the team approach with the developer, with the architect, with the engineer. Any more you want to add about that collaboration? You as a general contractor working with this, the developer obviously is in charge, but the architect, and how are you, if it's a three-legged, four-legged stool, kind of balancing that?
That's a great question, because generally we're the ones at the end of the food chain when everybody forgets about the issues once it gets into construction and they went on during design. But one of the things that we've learned is that keeping a project on track is usually less about controlling the process and more about creating the alignment early between the owner, the architect, the engineers, and the construction team. The best projects are typically the ones where everyone is communicating openly, understanding the same priorities, and solving problems together from the beginning. I know it's a little bit redundant. For us, collaboration really starts during pre-construction. We try to become involved early enough to provide practical feedback around budgeting, constructability, scheduling, phasing, and the overall project logistics while the design is still evolving. That allows the team to identify potential issues early and make informed decisions before they become expensive and disruptive later in the project. Transparency is also a major part of collaboration. Honest conversations around budget realities, schedule constraints, material lead times, and site conditions are incredibly important. In our experience, projects tend to struggle when difficult conversations are delayed or when different groups are operating from different assumptions. The earlier teams can align around realistic expectations, the more predictable the process becomes for everyone involved. We also try to approach projects from a mindset that everybody at the table brings value to the process. Developers are balancing financial and operating goals. Architects are focused on design and functionality. Engineers are solving technical challenges, and contractors are responsible for turning all of that into a successful physical project in the field. The strongest teams are usually the ones where perspectives are working together instead of operating in separate silos. In multifamily and affordable housing environments, there are typically a lot of stakeholders involved, and everyone has an opinion. There are very structured timelines and budgets, so communication becomes even more important. Once projects move into construction, there's usually far less flexibility while staying within budget and scheduling guardrails, which makes early coordination and trust across the team critical to keeping the projects moving successfully. We have found that good collaboration is really built on communication, transparency, and shared accountability. The best teams are the ones that avoid challenges. They are the ones that identify the issues early, work through them together before they become larger problems later in the project.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for that. And so when I'm working on a lot of projects, I wanted to shift gears to the actual costs and the budgets. Sometimes when there's sort of gaps within budgets, the word value engineering always comes up. Let's look at this and let's do some value engineering. So can you explain value engineering and how it applies to multifamily? And on a related note, what are some creative ways to actually reduce costs without sacrificing quality or the tenant experience?
It's a great topic, and one that I don't remember the last time there was a project where it wasn't talked about. Sometimes the term is used as a disguise for simply reducing scope. In our experience, the best value engineering conversations are much more thoughtful than that. It's really a discussion around aligning design intent, constructability, operational performance, and budget realities in a way that creates the best overall value for the long term. The goal should not simply be building cheaper. It should be around building smarter and more intentionally. A lot of that comes from experience and strong collaboration between the owner, design team, and contractor with the trade partners. Some of the best ideas in value engineering come from people who are actually building the projects out in the field. Strong trade partner relationships and a solid understanding of a particular product type can help identify opportunities to simplify systems, improve constructability, reduce schedule pressure, selection of materials that perform better over time without sacrificing the overall vision for the project. A good example of this is kitchens and bathrooms. They can create a significant cost swing as there are some of the higher cost elements within a home or a unit. Our team has spent a lot of time studying effective layouts for these areas that are efficient to build and function within the lived environment. This is very different than simply reducing square footage in general living areas, which are substantially lower in cost in relationship to one another. There's also important balance between first cost and life cycle cost. The least expensive solution up front isn't always the best long-term value for the owner or the residents, particularly in multifamily and affordable housing environments, where projects are often intended to serve communities for decades. Durability, maintenance requirements, operational efficiency, and long-term performance become very important parts of the conversation. We also try to be realistic about the difference between design ambition and operational reality. They are often opportunities to simplify complexity in ways that improve efficiency and reduce costs without negatively impacting the tenant experience or overall quality of the development. In many cases, thoughtful coordination and early planning create more value than dramatic late-stage redesign efforts. Good value engineering is usually less about eliminating scope and more about creating an aligning between project goals, budget, schedule, and the long-term operational needs of the development. The strongest outcomes typically come from teams that approach those conversations collaboratively and early in the process rather than waiting until projects are already under financial pressure.
Very good. And Mark, just one last question to kind of wrap it all up. And again, we know the construction number is the biggest number in a development budget. And we talked a lot about planning and coordination, but we know it's real estate development. There are risks. There's risks in real estate development. And if you have a $15, $20 million project and something goes awry, it's $1 million is a lot of gap. You, as the general contractor, how do you look at managing risk? The biggest question.
One of the things we've learned that projects rarely struggle because of one single issue. More often, challenges develop when smaller issues begin compounding over time without being identified and addressed early. In today's environment, some of the biggest risks during construction are schedule compression, labor availability, procurement timing, incomplete coordination, and late-stage decision-making. The longer issues are kicked down the road, the fewer options exist, and more often than not, leads to cost overruns and project delays. Construction projects today are highly coordinated systems with a tremendous number of moving parts. When communication breaks down and important decisions are delayed, it creates a ripple effect across procurement, scheduling, trade coordination, ultimately project costs. This is especially true in multifamily and affordable housing environments where projects are often operating with very strict and structured financing timelines and budgets with less flexibility once construction begins. One of the ways that we mitigate risk is through a disciplined pre-construction or early alignment between the project team. Honest conversations around budget realities, constructability, site conditions, and project priorities allow teams to identify challenges early while there's still flexibility to solve them thoughtfully. Transparency is also incredibly important. In our experience, projects perform best when teams are communicating openly, honestly, and addressing issues proactively instead of reactively. Difficult conversations do not become easier by delaying them. In fact, what we see is most major construction issues become significantly more manageable when they're identified early and worked through as a team before they become impacting field operations. We also place a strong emphasis on maintaining realistic schedules and consistent and continuous coordination throughout construction. Material lead times, trade sequencing, inspections, permitting, and labor availability all require constant communication and adjustment as projects move forward. The teams that stay aligned and adaptable throughout the process are generally the ones that maintain the greatest level of predictability. At the end of the day, risk mitigation is really about planning, communication, and trust across the entire project team. The strongest projects are usually not the ones without challenges. They're the ones where the team works and walks through the fire together and consistently to navigate the realities before the larger disruptions happen later in the projects.
Very good. Mark, really appreciate you joining and kind of covering a lot of those topics. That's it for this episode of The Buzz House, catching up with Mark Carlson of Carlson Construction about various matters around construction costs and risk mitigation and the process in general. Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrett Gibson.
Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at build@BakerTilly.com. That's build@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.